Committee will come to order. We will start with the calling of the roll.
Chairman Holmberg?
Aye, here.
Senators Cook?
Here.
Heckerman?
Here.
Wardner?
Here.
Representatives Delzer?
Here.
Boucher?
Here.
Quamine? Pollard?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Okay, we have a quorum. I've made an administrative decision. We are not going to review the supplementary rules of operation and procedure because we all heard it this morning. So we're going to skip over that. So we're way ahead of schedule. We've been tasked by the legislature to look at revenue projections as we did during the last biennium. And we will be receiving some information today about trends and revenue forecasts, collections, etc. We will hear about why one of the most interesting areas of difficulty has to do with corporate income tax, and we made some changes before on the apportioning of corporate income, which the procrastinators were not exactly exact on what actually happened. So we will hear today from the tax department. We will have a proposal of an RFP to find some experts to assist us during the upcoming biennium. We will go through that, and it was provided to the committee members for their review beforehand, homework. And then we will approve an RFP, can be amended, whatever. And then we will also look at a date for our next meeting where folks who have put in their proposals will present to this committee. And then this committee will determine whether or not we have a recommendation, which goes to the chairman of legislative management who signs the contracts. So, and because he's here, we'll make sure that he's happy when we do that. One of the experiences we found last time, we did not, as you recall, have many bidders on our RFP. We actually ended up with two, but one of them was ineligible because they didn't turn in their paperwork till after the deadline. So we had one proposal. Hopefully this time we will have multiple proposals, but we have no way of knowing that for sure. Some would ask, why do we have this other set of numbers? Aren't we just piggybacking on OMB? But if you look at when Adam goes through the history sheet, you will see that we kind of used the numbers that we had from OMB and the numbers that we had from IHS. They were kind of bookends, and the legislature worked. In fact, our last one was really kind of in the middle of what those two bookends happened to be. So we've got some work cut out for us, and we will start now with Adam talking about the memorandums.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so for the background information, there's three different memorandums that we prepared for the committee's consideration. The first one is the background memorandum related to the committee and its study. So just not to repeat the things that you've already covered, there wasn't a specific bill that created this committee this time. Last time there was a bill, but this is just kind of a continuation of that same committee with similar structure and same purpose. There are a few other revenue-related studies also occurring during the interim this time. The Legacy Fund Earnings Committee, which met earlier, is also looking at, you know, essentially a revenue-related item, how the earnings would filter in or affect the budget. The Legislative Management assigned a study of the charitable gaming to the Taxation Committee for this interim. There's a study of state agency fees that's being done in coordination with the state auditor's office, and that's the Government Finance Committee that's looking at those fees. The Travel Taxation Issues Committee is working again this interim and looking at the tax agreements that are set up between the state and the tribes or potential agreements that might be formed. And then there's also a study on the alternative tax for liquid nicotine that's the Taxation Committee will be looking at this interim. So there's some other revenue-related studies that may or may not have some bearing on the budget for next time and what the committee is looking at. The revenue forecasting process, just to briefly review that, OMB prepares forecasts for consideration in developing the state budget for the executive branch and their consideration, as well as the Legislative Assembly's consideration during session. They work with Moody's on developing their forecast. They also have a revenue advisory committee that meets that includes input from industry personnel. The Legislative Assembly at the end of the day has the responsibility for approving the state budget, including the revenue forecast. And the Appropriations Committee, will adopt the initial revenue forecast during the first week of the session, and then they'll adopt a final base revenue forecast in March. And then that combined with any other tax changes that get approved by the Legislative Assembly would make for the revenue for the official revenue forecast for the biennium. Talking about the past few sessions and the development of how things unfolded, as you well know, there was some turbulent times in the 15-17 biennium that ended up leading to the creation of a committee last interim to take a second look at forecasting to help try to get a better handle on where things might be headed. And so last interim, this committee was working and contracted with IHS Markit for consulting services. IHS worked with our office, the Legislative Council. We provided them with historical tax data and other information. We were able to also gather some information from the tax department and other state agencies as we compiled information for them. And then we passed that along to IHS. IHS used that information and the data to match economic trends with the historical tax collections, and they developed some custom forecasting models to forecast the sales tax, the motor vehicle excise tax, the individual and corporate income taxes. They also did some work with the oil and gas production and prices. And then IHS, in addition to reporting to the committee, they also provided the reports and the updates to the appropriations committees during the 2019 session. During the 2019 session, as was previously mentioned, then the Appropriations Committee did approve the March forecast, which ended up being kind of a combination of the both of the forecasts from OMB and from IHS. And then at the bottom is a proposed study plan for the committee's consideration, again, to potentially consult for consulting services related to economic forecasting, monitoring the actual revenue collections, receiving information from industry representatives and also state agencies, and then preparing the final reports and any other testimony that may come in from other interested persons. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that would conclude that first memorandum. I can answer any questions.
Are there any questions of Adam of the first memorandum? Okay.
Continuing on then, the second memorandum in the packet has two graphs, two colored graphs on it. So this deals with income tax collections. So this includes some information that we had gathered from the tax department in preparation for IHS doing the forecast last time, the economic consultant. And so for the committee's benefit to see and understand some of the data that goes behind the scenes and also to understand some of the correlations between what's happening with the tax collections and the underlying data. We put this information together so you could see some of those trends. So in the income tax, we broke it out into kind of the two main components of the income tax collections. There are the estimated payments as well as the wage withholdings. For the estimated payments, that would include the estimated payments that are made on a quarterly basis as well as payments that are made at the time a tax return is submitted. So those were included together for this purpose. Those were lumped together as kind of estimated payments. They're not, they're maybe a little bit more unknown, I guess, and fluctuate a little bit more. And the estimated payments generally are going to be associated with things like business income, capital gains, maybe certain distributions from retirement accounts. And to note on here, the income tax collections, as well as the estimated payments and the wage withholdings, these are all reflections of numbers before any transfers are made to the refund reserve accounts. So if you were to align the numbers for the total collections, the total income tax collections, with the revenue reports that come out, it wouldn't quite match up, because these would be before those transfers are made. So looking at the estimated payments, you can just see some of the trends in there and how it fluctuated and has been maybe a little bit more stable in the past few years. Looking at the bottom graph there with the wage withholdings, the two components that are included in this would be the withholdings that the company is withholding for employees' wages, as well as companies withholding royalty payments on out-of-state royalty owners. So both of those being kind of withholding type items that are lumped together here for these purposes. And so a lot of those tend to be a little bit more stable, because they're tracking with the royalties, maybe not as stable, but the wages tend to be more stable. So that kind of follows more of a linear pattern throughout here. And you can see that trending in the bottom there. So with that, I can answer any questions.
Representative Delzer.
Mr. Chairman Adam, would farm income be in estimated payments? It'd obviously be in the 502 in the end. How much of the farm would be in estimated, and how would there be any in withholding other than people hired?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's a correct description. So if a spouse, I guess, was working somewhere else that was withholdings on a paycheck, that would not be in the estimated payment necessarily. Or if there were hired hands on the farm that were being paid and that was being withheld, it would not be part of it. But the rest of it, I believe, would be reported as part of the estimated payments and would fluctuate.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, Council, do either of you remember when we started withholding royalty payments?
Mr. Chairman,
2013?
I believe it was passed in the 2013 session. The initial payments started coming in about April of 2014.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, moving on to the final memorandum. So we decided to take a look at the numbers that IHS had provided as their estimates and compare those to the actual collections. So as previously mentioned, the final forecast was a combination of numbers from IHS as well as OMB and maybe some other adjustments. So these IHS numbers do not reflect the actual forecast that was approved by the Legislative Assembly, but these would reflect the numbers they had provided and were used as a basis for the decision on the final forecast. So just as a way to compare how their numbers played out in their forecasting. It's important to note a couple things, that this is just the last 6 months of the 17-19 biennium. It's, you know, we don't know how we'll compare going into the future. At this point, we would have to wait and see. So it is just a short time period to look at. And there, the IHS market estimates were based on actuals through January, but then due to the timing of when the forecast needed to be presented, they didn't have numbers for February at that point when they presented it in March. So it would just be actuals through January, and based on their estimates. And IHS also did their estimates on a quarterly basis, so not necessarily on a month-to-month basis, but on a quarterly basis. So we broke it out on a quarterly basis to kind of reflect how they had done their estimates as well. So there could be fluctuations within the quarter. Maybe 1 month would have been higher or lower, but they didn't, you know, they don't break that out. They just provide that quarterly estimate. So with that, highlighting just kind of the main differences there, the sales and use tax collections. So when you see the positive $16 million and the 3.8%, the actual collections were over IHS estimates. So that means that essentially IHS, their forecast, they under-forecasted the collections essentially there. Then moving to like motor vehicle excise tax collections, in that case, they had over-forecasted, so we're about, the actual collections would have been about $3 million less than their forecast. And then the individual and corporate income tax collections as well. So on a percentage basis, maybe not too significant of a difference. And then, you know, as well, dollar-wise, looking more around $60 million difference. So in the span of those 6 months. I can answer any questions that you might have about this.
And of course, for our purposes, we prefer to have it come in above the actuals rather than come in below, and then we are scrambling. Are there any questions? Representative Delzer.
Mr. Chairman, Adam, when you look at the April to June, they seem to be pretty close on most of those. Is that the last information we had? Was the April to June, and then future, or did we just get the future? When they came in March, what all did they give us?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, so they had provided for the remainder of the seven, their forecast would have been based on, I guess their actuals, I guess, would have been based through the end of December because of the quarterly numbers, so they would have done the actuals through then, and they may have made a slight revision to their first quarter of calendar year 2019, so that January to March number, they may have made a slight revision, but they were forecasting essentially from January of 2019 through the end of the 2019-21 by any means. So.
Okay. The next item is presentation by OMB regarding status, etc. And I may have missed this, but the comment was that OMB is working with Moody's Analytics over the next, is that you're in the contract with them for this next period?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Joe Morissett from the Office of Management and Budget. On the first page of my presentation is a status statement as we close out the 2017-19 biennium. And although that, of course, ended June 30, that month stays open until almost the end of July. And so it has taken us until, honestly, last night to verify these numbers and make sure that everything was accounted for correctly. So fresh off the presses, this is a statement similar to what you've seen, you know, each time that I presented to you over the interim. But now as we close it out, I'll just kind of walk through those numbers again. We have, of course, our $65 million statutory limit in the general fund, and then we have other money that's carried into the biennium based on approved carryover for construction projects or IT projects. So that shows up in our beginning balance that's available. And then our revenue number as we finished the biennium was $4.913 billion. And that compares to the March 2019 estimate that was adopted in the legislative process of about $4.66 billion. So a difference there of about $250 million. And then on the expenditure side, we have the original one-time and ongoing appropriations. We have that authorized carryover that gets added to what can be spent in the biennium. And then we have some authority that was spent in the current biennium based on emergency provisions that you passed last session, where that money could be spent immediately before June 30. So that was added to our added to the total at $106 million. In some cases, you provide an emergency appropriation that is only good for the through June 30 of 2019. In other cases, it's available for either biennium. So that $106 million relates to appropriations that had an emergency clause, but were actually available for all of the 1921 biennium as well. Then we had an adjustment which related to the Dickinson State University appropriation, where they did not start construction for the Theodore Roosevelt Library building by December. That appropriation was canceled, so that comes out as an adjustment to the appropriations. And then we have supplemental appropriations, which were those deficiency appropriations that you passed last time. So that gives us a total of $4.5 billion. That's the total authority. We reduce that by the amount that's returned to the general fund at the end of the biennium, and that amount is just a little over $50 million. That was very close to the estimates that you used in your budget, which were about $47 million. So in the end, the combination of that additional revenue and that slightly larger turnback gives us an ending balance of about $612 million. And only $65 million of that can stay in the general fund, so the rest gets transferred to the Budget Stabilization Fund. That gives us a transfer of about $546 million to the Budget Stabilization Fund, and that compares to the estimate that you had in front of you when you were here during session of about $285 million. So what that means is when we add that to the about $114 million that's in the fund now, that gives us a total of about $660 million. And the maximum balance that can be in that fund based on 15% of the general fund appropriations is about $726. So that's a difference of about $67 million. So that means of that $75 million that is authorized to go in the fund from oil tax allocations, only about $67 million or potentially less based on earnings of the fund would be needed. And that fund would fill up then based on the oil tax estimates sometime after the 1st of January, probably sometime between January and April of 2020.
And then all of that money would go into the SIF?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That would be just additional monies in the state buckets, and it would stay and actually accumulate extra money in SIF, right? And then it's important to note, though, that as soon as that budget stabilization fund is filled, the interest is no longer retained in the fund, and that would be general fund interest. And so there would be some gain for the general fund as that interest would accrue to the general fund instead of the budget stabilization fund. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions on that page. If not, I'll move on to page 2. Page 2, Mr. Chairman, is the familiar chart that you see in our newsletter that shows the comparison of actual revenues to the forecast. For this one, it's the closeout of the biennium, so it's also got, you know, the $250 million number in the bottom right that I mentioned as our overall variance from the legislative forecast. So this is a comparison not to the original 2017 forecast, but to the forecast that you adopted in 2019. So, like I typically say, you know, that monthly variance, I don't like to focus too much on that because there's so many things that skew that month as a month ends on a weekend or, you know, as tax filings flop into the next month. So I don't know that those numbers are so important, but I think on the far right side, you know, for those major tax types, for sales, motor vehicle, and individual, finished the biennium very close to the legislative forecast. Around a percent variance in those tax types. The one that, of course, continues to miss the forecast by a wide margin is the corporate income tax. And, it seems like those estimated payments continue to exceed what it seems like they should based on data that the tax department has, based on filers that would benefit from the single sales factor apportionment method that they're not electing it, and net operating losses that we know are on the books that seem to not be offset with the estimated payments. And so, just a heads up that could be something that corrects itself when we see most of those returns filed in October, in which case it would be a timing issue between bienniums where we would have exceeded the forecast here but have an issue in the next biennium. But this is so much stronger than the forecast that it's been a little hard to understand exactly why. But those are the things that we're watching, and you know could could resolve themselves. We could see some reduction in those collections as we get to the time when those returns are actually filed, because these are based on estimated payments at this point. And then, of course, the big variance on here, Mr. Chairman, is the legacy fund number, which ended up being $455 million, as you heard in your last meeting, compared to the $300 million that was in the final forecast. So, Mr. Chairman, happy to answer any questions on that page.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Delzer, then Senator Cook.
Okay, so Joe, then we have to take 155 off of the 249 to get the... number that we're actually ahead on our ongoing side?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct. If you want to just look at the tax types, you'd have to take out that $155 million variance, right?
The question I have for you, Joe, is the reduced amount from the state mill, and I understand that'd just be a percentage of their profits, but the question I have, did they, the Industrial Commission or whatever, make more improvements that reduced their profits? Or what happened there?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Delzer, I don't have a good answer for them. I'm not sure what affected their profitability. I'm going to turn and look behind me and see if... I'm sorry. We don't know. We can dig into it and see if we can get a response and, you know, provide it to council or...
I'd like to know whether it was from further investments to, you know, change the scope of the mill or whatever, or if it was just that their profits were that much less.
Sure. We'll dig into that and see what we can find out.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, Joe, this corporate income tax, so of the $60 million that we show in surplus here, are you saying that a lot of that's in our bank because of an estimated tax payment, and that eventually they may file their tax return and elect to take the single sales factor, and so a lot of that money will have to be refunded?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, I'm not sure if that would affect it. I think that can... They'd have to elect that going forward, wouldn't they? They couldn't elect that retroactively. So it would have to, so it wouldn't affect that, but the net operating loss issue, which does not seem to be reflected in estimated payments, that could be an issue where corporations are overpaying and it gets refunded when those returns are filed.
So some of the $60 million is at risk of being refunded?
I think that's possible, yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on to page 3, which is our first look at the new biennium. It's the month of July. And so we have a comparison of actual to forecast on here as well. And this also relates to page 4, which is a monthly cash flow in very small print of each month of the biennium by tax type. So those numbers that are in that July column on page 4 correspond to what's in this July column on page 3, just to point out the connection. As we worked on the cash flow for this forecast, I'll just say we were in a little bit different position for this, because we had to come up with a monthly cash flow for a forecast that did not exactly fit our model, because as you said, Mr. Chairman, it was not what OMB had proposed and not exactly what IHS had proposed, but somewhere in the middle. And in fact, in the case of the sales tax number, if you looked at what actual 19 collections were, this actually would be a decline each year in the forecast that was adopted. And so that did not fit the model at all that we had. So we had to look at how we would cash flow this. And so what we did is we took kind of an analytical approach to it. We split the biennial number that you adopted by fiscal year, and in the case of the sales tax number, we split it based on what IHS had provided you, which was almost a 50-50 split. It was about 49.7% the first year, 50.3% the second year. So we used that kind of a split between the years, and then to break it out by month within the year, we just looked back at the last 4 years and said, in the month of July, if that has averaged 8% of those fiscal year collections in the month of July, that's the amount of that annual amount that's going to be in the month of July. And if it's 9% in, or 10% or whatever in August, then we're going to use 10% of that fiscal year total for the month of August. And that's what we're going to compare to. So in this first month, you know, again, you hate to draw too many conclusions from a single month, but we've exceeded the sales tax forecast by a pretty wide margin, individual income tax, and, you know, percentage-wise, and in dollar amounts, pretty significant numbers on sales and individual. Other ones, dollar amounts are closer. But so that's the first look at the month of July, and that's kind of the methodology that we used for all those major tax types in how we broke that out by month. So, Mr. Chairman, that really is what I had to present to you today, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Delzer.
Joe, do you have where that sales tax came in at?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Delzer, we won't have that for, there's kind of a quarter delay there as that data is processed and analyzed by the tax department to figure out where those sales tax returns, where those taxable sales took place. So it'll be a little bit of a delay. Like for this month of July, those are actually June sales, and so we wouldn't have that until like after September, maybe. After September, probably we'd have that data.
So you're a month behind to start with.
Like well, the oil, tax,
the
tax,
oil, we're 2 months behind.
Right.
But for, your July numbers are June collections?
No, Mr. Chairman, the July numbers are July collections, but it's based on taxable sales that took place in the month of June. And then those sales tax permit holders have until the end of the following month to pay the tax that's due on those July on those June transactions. So somebody buys something in June, the sales tax permit holder pays that sales tax due to the state by the end of July.
Yes, Representative Zolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe and Paul, apologies for my ignorance as I don't serve on appropriations, so some of this is all new to me. On page 4, under tax type, both insurance premium, oil and gas, and oil extraction, there are months that you are estimating we're collecting and then months where we're not. And I know we have a cap of what we take for oil and gas. So is this just for budgeting purposes and those, so like the month of December 19 where we're not, you don't have any forecasts, is that money going elsewhere? Can you explain those holes?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bashi, that's totally correct. We have the different buckets of general fund revenue and the other buckets in that tier. And so this, based on the forecast assumptions for price and production, is how it breaks out where we would fill up the general fund, the first tier of the general fund buckets of $200 million, and then it would go to the tax relief fund, and then it would go again to the general fund, and then after that it would go to the other buckets on that list.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And now we have the man who has all the answers about apportioning corporate income tax.
Yes. See, before we go there,
yes.
If I may, Alan, doesn't the budget stabilization bucket come before the second general fund?
I believe it's right after that.
Right after that?
I think it's general fund, tax relief, general fund, okay. And budget stabilization. Is that right, Adam?
Yeah. Yes. But it's before the second one, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so the order of the buckets would be the general fund, the first $200 million, the tax relief fund, the next $200 million, budget stabilization fund, $75 million, and then we go back to the general fund for the last $200 million. That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, Ryan, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ryan Rauschenberger, Office of State Tax Commissioner. I handed out a single page that has both of my categories on it that I'd like to talk about. Starting off with the single sales factor option for apportioning income, as we've been talking about already, just to give you a little bit of history, typically the method for apportioning income is based on property, payroll, and sales. This election basically would more heavily weight sales. So that's basically an incentive for companies, for example, like a manufacturing company that would have most of their sales going out of state to reduce their tax liability here. This law was passed in 2015, so the first year that it was effective was 2016, as you can see. We had over 11,000 corporate income tax returns from tax year 2016. 116 of those elected the double-weighted factor. So for 2016, it was double-weighting. 2017, it's also double-weighting. 2018 is the first year where it's 75% weight on sales. And then finally, 2019 is the first year of 100% option for a company to elect, and would all be on sales if they make that election. Keep in mind that this is a five-year election, so it's if you do elect, you have to stay in the system for 5 years. As was mentioned earlier, not as many companies are electing to take this as we had thought. And when we did an analysis of the top 25 companies that we thought would take this, a number of them have. As you can see, in 2016, 116 of them got a $2.2 million benefit. 2017, 168 companies got a $4.2 million benefit. And we do not have 2018 numbers yet because those returns are going to come in later this year. So those are due in October. So there is quite a bit of a lag here. But a number of those companies, I believe, at least in my opinion, aren't taking the election because it is a five-year binding election. And each year, even though they might benefit in 2016 or 17, they're not necessarily going to benefit the second, third, or fourth year. And the 168 filers, as you can see, it's only a $4.2 million reduction. When this bill passed in 2015, we had a much higher fiscal note on the bill, thinking that more companies would take it. But at this point,
do you recall what that was? Was that 30,
Kathy? 50.
15.
Oh, okay, 15. Okay. So we're not quite there yet. But as the sales factor gets more heavily weighted, you can expect that number to increase. So right now, fairly small number at 4.2 million for this most recent year. Interim, we can have that 2018 data for you. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try answer any questions.
Are there any questions on this section?
Sellers.
Oh, Senator Cook, you look guilty.
I am. Mr. Chairman, Ryan, when we pass this, I can think of many companies, any one of them all by themselves, that would have a fiscal note or cost the state more than $2.2 million. Now, we're not going to talk about him because you're not going to reveal anything anyway, but
right.
What happened?
You know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, that's a good question. Each company has their own circumstances of why they may or may not choose to elect. And part of it might be because of the five-year. If a company could elect each year off and on and not be binded for 5 years, I think you actually would see more companies electing this. At least in my discussions with companies, I believe that it's the five-year election.
We're not the only state that's gone this route. Do other states allow them to flip the toggle back and forth on and off? Aren't they all five-year election?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, most states, I should ask Kathy, I think we're the only state that actually has an election. Yeah, other states have single-weighted sales factor or more heavily weight the sales factor, but they don't have the election. So it is unique to North Dakota that you can actually choose one of the two. It's for example, Minnesota, they phased it in, but it was mandatory. So I believe that they're actually fully weighted single-weighted sales factor right now. But other states, you don't have the option to elect.
So they create losers and winners when they don't have the election. But we're not seeing near the winners we expected to see.
That's true. That's true.
And there's really no reason why.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, other than, I don't know, Kathy, if you have any other...
Well, the NOLs you mentioned.
Well, that's a good point. As Joe mentioned earlier, some of the companies that, for example, like in 2015 when the bill passed, a lot of companies that had a liability, say in 2014, had losses in the last few years and just don't have any liability at all. And then when a corporation has losses, you get to carry forward those losses to offset future income.
Yeah.
So when a company, when we did the analysis back in 2014 and 15, the playing field's a lot different now because a lot of those companies that were profitable aren't anymore. And if you look at the historical corporate income tax trends, it's considerably down. And when a company has losses, they could carry that forward for a number of years, which is why we see the volatility in corporate income tax. When a company is making money, they pay. When they aren't making money, they may not pay for a number of years.
Representative Delzer.
So, Ryan, are we set up that this is ongoing? We didn't put any date certain to switch one way or the other? It's just going to be an election all the way through?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delzer, starting in 2019, so basically a company, there is no end date on this. There's no sunset. When a company elects, it's binding for 5 years. And starting in 2019, it'll be 100% weighting on sales instead of double weighting or 75% like we're seeing right now. So there is no end date to this.
Okay, continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, at the bottom of the page, you can see remote seller sales tax. Things are going very well in that area. We have, since last June, we've had almost 5,000 new registrants as far as remote sellers. You can see that since last June, we've collected just over $15 million from those nearly 5,000 companies. You can see $11.7 million is the state portion with $3.6 million of the local portion. I believe it was mentioned earlier that the current forecast has $25 million that we're banking on from remote sellers, and you can see that we're well on our way to meeting and exceeding those numbers. I believe it's $10 million for the first year of this biennium and $15 million for the second year, so we're well on our way.
Yes, Representative Elzer.
Well, Ryan, what time period is you're looking at from June 21 of 18 all the way through July?
Mr. Chairman,
stop this at the end of the biennium.
Mr. Chairman, this Representative Delzer, this would include what was last month?
2 weeks here in August. So it's all the way to current.
Right. So it is current, and just so you know, the reason June 21, 2018 is the date is that was the Supreme Court decision date. So that was the first date that we had the legal authority to enforce on remote seller sales tax.
Do you have the numbers for July and the first 2 weeks of August separate by themselves?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delzer, we could get that for you.
Any other questions of Ryan on this issue? Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we have our headliner.
He's here all week.
Good afternoon, Senator Chairman Holmberg and members of the committee. John Godfrey, North Dakota Insurance Commissioner. I'm handing around my testimony now. Was asked to give an update on 1106 and the reinsurance program. Remember, House Bill 1106 established the Invisible Reinsurance Program for North Dakota's individual health insurance market. I can go through some of those numbers again if you'd like. The kind of the main gist of the update on the testimony, I don't need to read it for you all, is our numbers haven't changed, and the reason for that is we haven't implemented the program yet. We just got federal approval August 1st. They signed off on, and we're good to go. We'll be launching this for the 2020 plan year. So we should be seeing those rate reductions when we announce the rates here in October. October 1st is generally when we announce the rates. Confident to tell you that we will be seeing 20%, if not more, of a reduction in our individual marketplace, which is a very big deal for those individuals who've got to go out and purchase their health insurance. Like I said, the fiscal notes that were included in the bill were the 31-70206 for the 19 to 21 biennium, and then the 11,627,742 for the 21-23 biennium. Those are offset a little bit by our biennial years, given that the program will start January 1 of 2020 and will is set for a sunset December 31 of 2021. So we'll have 2 years of essential data when we come back into the next legislative session to talk about this program again. We're confident with the numbers that have been supplied. I think if I were a betting man, I'm optimistic that they may come in lower, but these are the numbers that we were comfortable with supplying, but we'll know a whole lot more once we get the program up and running. And I'm happy to answer any questions or go into any more detail you want. I didn't want to necessarily take your time by reading my testimony if you didn't need me to.
During the session, you made some very good pitches, and obviously you were successful in getting what you got. And then you went out and your department did some educating of people and getting input from others as far as their reactions. Can you give us a flavor of what you were hearing and what folks out there were telling you?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We went out and did our annual statewide tour. Essentially, we go out and meet with the agents and the communities all across the state and kind of talk about what came through this session. I will tell you there is a significant amount of frustration around the healthcare marketplace. That shouldn't be a surprise. But our agents and frankly our farmers and our ranchers have been very excited about this program and the opportunity to at least provide some relief for the near term and allowing them to keep that in the marketplace. I think the goal with this is hopefully to buy us some time to another whatever a larger scale reform would be. Some of the issues that have been talked about in Congress are doing a federal implementation of this very program that will allow the states to essentially take the burden off the states for funding some of these programs. That's one option, all the way up to full-fledged reform. So the feedback we got was very, very positive on this program in terms of what this does for a lot of the agents that are out in the community, especially if they're working with in the rural areas. They're generally working with their farmers and ranchers, and that's where some of our, frankly, our horror stories come from, where families have had to forego insurance or have had to sell X number of head of cattle in order to make the payment this year. And so they were very optimistic this will, at the very least, keep people insured, if not be able to attract some folks back in. So there was, this was certainly a crowning highlight for us when we were talking about it, and it continues to be very well received. And I think as these rates will be released in October, I can anticipate that there'll be another, some more excitement about it as well.
I would have to say you did a good job of educating the legislature, because there was a lot of skepticism the first day you walked in and they saw the dollar amount. But Senator Wardner had a question.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Gottfried, will this also help all the insurance premiums in the state? For example, we look at our PERS program and stuff. Are we going to be able to see a leveling off or a reduction in those premiums too?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wardner, we anticipate that there will be some impact. I won't be able to splice it out and tell you what that impact will be, but just looking at the insurance market as a whole, when you've got a stable individual market, that keeps downward pressure on the rest of the groups, right? Because if folks who are in that individual market and can't afford to have insurance, it doesn't mean they don't get sick. It doesn't mean they don't go seek treatment. What that does mean is they go through a different avenue, and oftentimes our larger groups will have to pick up the tab for that uninsured coverage at times, or whether it's through the ER and some of the bad debt charity care that's put out there. Another big piece of this bill that will hopefully have a more dramatic impact on the market as we go forward is our healthcare cost study, and really driving at the provider level why it costs so much to receive healthcare. I've got my own inclinations and why some of those facts are, but we've got through this bill we were authorized the ability to go in and do a study that frankly no other state has done, and have the access to the provider data that I think is needed to kind of close the loop. Because when you talk about insurance and you talk about healthcare prices, the insurance companies say it's hospitals, the hospitals say it's the insurance companies, and in the middle is the consumer is getting kind of left out. And so we'll have an opportunity to put a scope around that, and we're doing that through the healthcare interim committee as well. I'm hopeful that next session we'll be bringing forward some good news on this program, some more data behind it, but also some other initiatives that will hopefully go at the price of healthcare, which, again, if the thing that you're insuring is on a trend curve like this, your insurance is going to be on a trend curve like that as well. So we're hopeful we'll be able to get to some of the root cause of the cost of healthcare in our state, but you know, we're working on it.
Commissioner, interest from other states who have looked, have you been doing some outreach?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, even through this very morning, we had a call with Oklahoma. We are the first state that's gotten the structure that's been approved, that was approved by you all in terms of the assessment and the tax credit model. Oklahoma is very interested in looking at how we structured that. There are other states that have been kind of kicking the tires as well. We're the ninth state to have a reinsurance program approved. Colorado was in the same batch as we were, so we were 8 and 9. But at our national meetings, we received a lot of attention on the payment option that you guys authorized here with essentially reducing future revenues versus having to make an outlay at the beginning, which I think is for a while was difficult for CMS to swallow, but through the structure that we laid out and put forward, we had no issues getting that waiver granted. So yeah, we've had interest around it as well.
And what is the when you're talking to folks in other states and they are going to look either at regulatory agencies or to their legislature, what's the silver bullet you use to indicate how you were able to get this done?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and
besides a brilliant legislature.
Well, much of the deference goes to you all. I'm on the executive branch, so I don't get to make policy. And so it was a lot of the discussions we had going forward, the interim study we did, the work we put in behind it. But I think at the end of the day, what we're seeing is, especially rural states are looking at this program as, as a way to help those farmers and ranchers, because that's that group of the population that I talked about that has been, frankly, left out of the ACA discussion. They don't have employer-sponsored health care. They don't receive it through the government. They're on the individual market, and their only option is to go through these marketplaces to buy that. And when you've seen year over year of 20% plus increases, you're essentially going to price them out of the market eventually. And we're not alone in that. I mean, we're not the only rural state that has a large agriculture background. And so I think that has kind of become there's a tipping point that we've all hit, that the small business owners can't afford to maintain the path we're on. And a reinsurance program like this, at the very least, buys us some time to find fuller reform and a more comprehensive look at it, which is, I think, needed. I think we can all agree that it's needed.
Representative Delzer had a question.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, a few questions. One is, and this probably should be the last one answered, but what kind of number are we actually talking about taking advantage of it? And then you said something about these being ones that don't have insurance, so it falls on others. My understanding on this is that this is mostly high level. The reason they aren't part of the market or the government market is because they're high income level or high asset level. And wouldn't the hospitals go after those people? You know, I don't understand why it would necessarily fall on everybody else, because it's not like they're poor as such. It's simply a case where it's awful hard to come up with that scratch every month for the insurance.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Delzer, answering your second question first, I think some of the folks who will be receiving, who maybe have been either priced out of the market, again, they'll still receive care or seek care at some point if it gets to a point where they need it, and not where they may find themselves in financial trouble. Now, certainly there are some folks who receive assistance to this marketplace through an advanced premium tax credit, and so they've got incentive to stay in the marketplace, but it doesn't stop the small farm family who's got, I can think of one example, they've got a set of twins and can't afford the insurance. A medical catastrophe with them would still leave them to...
Yeah, but don't they have to be above 400% of poverty to not qualify for the marketplace?
If they're above the 400% of poverty, they don't get the advanced premium tax credit. So they're still in the marketplace, and so they just don't get any assistance.
Right, but they're above 400% of poverty. That's a pretty high number.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Delzer, it can be, but one NICU baby can certainly throw you into a medical bankruptcy very quickly.
Well, I understand that, but when, you know, you were saying that this might lower everybody else's because this would cover people that weren't, but, you know, they also have the assets, so the hospital would charge them as private pay, and they'd go after them. You know, in anything I've ever seen, the hospital don't back away just because it's going to break somebody.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Delzer, I don't disagree with that. They're going to be they're going to certainly go after the ones they can. It doesn't mean they're going to get everyone they can. And it's also that's where I was answering Senator Wardner's question. That's a difficult number to give on what this will do to the other marketplaces. But what I can tell you is that a stable individual market helps keep downward pressure on the rest of the rates across the marketplace. So this primarily attacks the individual marketplace, but it provides stability to everybody else. And one of the ways it provides stability is it takes those peaks and valleys out of that individual marketplace. And we've seen this individual market become, frankly, sicker because the folks who are remaining on the individual marketplace need that care, need that coverage. And so as that population gets sicker and sicker, you see higher and higher medical claims coming out of that. And if we can take the peaks out of that through a reinsurance program like this, that stability gets passed on to everybody else.
So again, what kind of numbers are we looking at?
So we've got 42,000 North Dakotans who in 2018 who were on the individual marketplace. About 21,000 of those received a tax credit, so the APTC. So the other 21,000 are the unsubsidized. And it's our estimation that about a quarter of a percent of that will hit that reinsurance level, that $100,000 in claims. But within that quarter percent who hit that, we've got $3-4 million claim years in those individuals.
So what kind of number of people are we actually covering with this?
In terms of, well, there's 42,000 people who will be eligible for the reinsurance program, and about a quarter percent of that.
You said 21 of those are already on the tax credit side, so they would.
But they'll still be part of the reinsurance pool because they'll get that. So of the 21,000 who received the tax credit, right? They still have claims years, and they'll still have high claims cost years. Where the other 21,000 of the unsubsidized, that's the population that's going to see the 20% reduction, and so that's the folks who are really going to be. I believe benefiting from this most. The folks who are on the subsidies, their premiums are capped.
21,000? I don't think you'll have all 21,000. That's the number. What 8,000? 10,000? What are you?
I don't have my calculator. I would do a quarter of a percent to 42,000 would be the number who is going to hit the reinsurance.
Quarter of a percent.
Yep. I don't have my calculator on me, but again, by addressing that quarter of a percent, we're doing a 20% reduction on the rest of the market. So it goes to, again, illustrate what we've all known or what we've talked about for a number of years is that there are a small number of individuals who have a high claims cost year that drive prices for everybody else. That's what insurance is. We pay in and we cover everybody else's costs. And if we can take the high outliers out of that, we bring the cost down for everybody else. And that's what this reinsurance program does.
Representative Boucher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions on this specifically and then something ancillary when we're done with this. Commissioner, you keep using the 20% number that will see reductions around 20%. When will we know what that actual reduction will be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boshi, we'll be releasing it for public consumption October 1st. We're still in the filing process right now. I'm encouraged by the numbers I've seen. I'll kind of leave it at that.
Great. And my second to that is, you know, this is, we're talking about this in terms of the individual marketplace, but when you talk about that quarter 1% and the 400 some or 200 some families that would that carry that much of an impact on our entire pool, is there some sort of model or similar to this that then something like a PERS or other the privates are providing, or is this limited because of how it's structured to everyone that's left floating without coverage?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boucher, it's reinsurance is a fundamental tenet of insurance in general. The reason it's been very difficult to implement in the health marketplace is frankly because it's very volatile, and so there's never been a strong desire in the past for private reinsurers to enter into this marketplace. There's a growing need here, and I think that's why you're seeing the 1332 waivers pick up speed and pick up some, well, they're picking up implementation anyway. This to me is the individual market it's about 8% of our country is on the individual market, or 12% maybe. So it's a small kind of bite at that first reinsurance look. And so I think we'll know a lot more as we get through this on a goal, but again, the reality is reinsurance makes sense independent of the ACA in a lot of respects. So it's a fundamental principle of insurance. And we've just seen those high claims costs are getting higher. And it's again, if we can address the outliers, again, we can take those rates down for everybody else. Because when you're trying to build a rate through an insurance company and you've got to mark in for a $3 million claims year, that skews everybody else's rates. And if I can take that down and say it's okay, the max we can do is about 100,000, or you know, 100,000 plus a little bit more, you know, that's a much easier number to drive to.
Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Not related to reinsurance, but okay. Well, the commissioner's here if it's okay. And I don't know the appropriate language, but Congress last year passed some sort of policy that would allow, so for instance, realtors, real estate agents throughout the state could pile together a new plan. I know there's been some hiccups. Can you talk about those hiccups and if there's any potential fixes?
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Boucher, I think you're talking about the Association Health Plan rules. So that Association Health Plan rule was, it was an executive order. I'll go into a little bit of it in depth here, but in 2017, when I first came on board, we passed some new, through an administrative code, through administrative rules, we updated our multiple employer welfare arrangements. So that's essentially the MEWAs, which are essentially association health plans. It allows smaller employers to band together to get large group access. So we updated those rules in trying to improve access to those marketplaces. The association health plan rule came out and was in action, I guess. We had a number of associations looking within our state about creating an association health plan. Unfortunately, in March, the DC District Court found the rule to be unconstitutional or outside the bounds of the president's authority. So that has essentially put everything on pause. So we don't have really any new association health plans being formed in our state. It's something we're going to continue to work with the Department of Labor on, and to see if we can, if there's any other pathways we can get going forward. I will tell you, this is one area that is it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. We've got some like-minded association groups that simply because they're small, they're not able to get to the economies of scale that a large group would need to get to, and by banding together, they could do that. And because of some ERISA rules and some of the rules coming out of DC, they're prevented from doing that. And we're trying to find solutions to get people covered and get it affordable. I'd say the disagreement that's happening across the country is on whether or not those association health plans would disrupt the ACA, the individual market. And what the argument is that by allowing, let's say, realtors to form together and get an association health plan, they will not be in the individual market. And that takes good risk out of the individual market, which then will, they, in their opinion, will crumble that market. It's my contention that, again, we need to get folks affordable coverage. And the best way to do that is, in one way, is to do that is through an association health plan, especially, again, given given the rules we've updated here in North Dakota. There's consumer protections in there. There's regulation oversight. We regulate the financials. So back in the 80s, when the association health plans first came on board and there was a bunch of bankruptcies and folks lost their shirts, we have now got regulations in our admin code to prevent those things to happen. So that decision's under appeal. We're expecting a decision probably early winter to mid-spring. So,
Representative Lauzer was here, and I didn't recognize him. He's on legislative management, and he had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is this on 1106, or is this?
I'm easily unrecognized. This is actually on Senate Bill 86 in North Carolina, and I understand, I don't know if you followed this, but that association health plan passed in the North Carolina legislature, and they're lobbying their governor to sign it. I don't know the process there, but it is Senate Bill 86, and my understanding is that their governor has 10 days to sign that legislation or it is not enacted. So I mean, there's a state that proceeded regardless of executive action.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Lauzer, the one of the main issues we have, and I'm not sure if that'll be successful, is that the federal government has control over these ERISA plans, and a lot of these would fall into an ERISA-like plan. And so we're anxiously watching North Carolina, but the information we've received back from the DOL, and I've been on a number of conference calls, and even then Secretary Acosta was out in North Dakota visiting us, trying to find that pathway forward. I'm not sure a state law will trump that. If North Carolina's got the bullet, it'll be the first bill out of our office for the 2021 session.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now we have on our agenda comments by interested people regarding the committee study. This would be any portion of the study which is essentially looking at revenue projections. No one is rushing to the microphone. Okay. Not a big surprise, but a good one. The next item is request for proposal. Each one of you received electronically a copy of the proposal, slightly edited, that was utilized 2 years ago. And I'm going to turn this over now to Adam to present this issue to us.
So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as you mentioned, this is largely the same as what was done last time. A couple of the changes would obviously be the date-related items. We updated the dates related to it. And then it was mostly clarifying items. So particularly in the information that would be provided by the consultant, we made it clear that we are looking for the tax collections to be forecasted, not just what the tax collections are based on, but the actual tax collections as was done this past time. So we just made sure that was clear in the RFP so that anyone that would be applying would be understanding that we'd be expecting that data from them. And then in addition to that, so that would mostly be starting at the bottom of the first page and then going on to the top of the second page where we just made it clear that it's the tax collections that we're looking for. In addition, so the last time when we did the RFP, I think things were kind of still unfolding at that time, and so we had requested specifically that the consultant present to the committee once and then provide an update in January, and that the March update was an optional item. But since it seemed to work well and coincide with all the forecasting, we made it clear that this RFP would be requesting those three reports, the report to the committee next fall with an initial forecast and then you know, January forecast as well as a March forecast. So those would be the major things that changed. You will notice at the bottom of the second page, we did kind of leave a blank in there as well as on the front page for the date of the RFP. So depending on when the committee schedules their next meeting, then we can also make any necessary adjustments to when the RFP would need to be responded to, when they would have to have their proposals in, and then the committee would be able to decide at their next meeting whether they would select any of the consultants.
Representative Gelser.
Well, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I don't, you know, remember anybody having a whole lot of complaints about what we received for information. But I did hear quite a few complaints about how it was presented. Do we have anything in here giving them what we expect the person in front of us to be able to answer or whatever? You know, because that was part of the discussion of, you know.
So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I guess we don't have necessarily specific details on the manner in which they would need to present. I guess we did try to clarify that they would present the reports to the committee at the state capitol. You know, whether we want to clarify that it needs to be in person or done electronically, I think there would be an assumption that it would be in person, but as far as other guidelines about how they would report, I guess we didn't necessarily outline any of those things. If there are certain things the committee would like to see added into there about how they would present a report to the committee, we could certainly add to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes, continue, please.
I don't know how we put it on paper, but I think when we actually interview these agencies or whoever, if anybody answers our RFP, we should maybe have a little discussion as a committee of what we kind of expect.
And that would certainly be part of the consideration that we would have, because
right.
I agree with you, and we had that conversation that the information we received was not bad information. In fact, it was pretty good information, but the devil was in the presentation. That could have been better. Does the committee think that leaving it as is, or at least putting in person, or is that something that is pretty well considered in the industry that you're going to present not on telephone, but Alan, what?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's pretty well, you know, anticipated that it would be in person when we say, you know, present the reports to the committee at the Capitol. But, you know, we could certainly add in person if you feel that would be more clarifying. It certainly wouldn't hurt anything.
Senator Wardner.
Well, I would agree. You know, they don't give enough detail. They just kind of, you know, nonchalantly go over it. You know, if they were in the classroom, they'd be chased out. We expect the details and lessons and education and how they got there and why. And so I don't think that's too much to expect.
So I think you should put in the in person. And of course, I could say something that is just heresy, and unfortunately, Joe is still here. It would be nice on the presentation that we have in March if you had the Moody's folks and then whoever these folks are, and then they sit at a table in front of us, the two groups, and we visit with them. I think that would be of interest. And I think it can be done. But, pardon? Oh, it would be fun, though.
So, Mr. Chairman, I do have a question for Joe.
Yes, please.
Joe?
Joe?
If I could, I don't remember the exact dollar figure that you have for Moody's, but what do you have for Moody's in the 1921?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delzer, I would have to look. I believe it's around 140 to 150,000 for the biennium, and that includes four
seemed to
forecast
me it was
160
the time before.
Pardon me?
Seemed to me it was 160 the time before.
It could be, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking around 150, but it, you know, it could be 160. I'd have to check to know for sure.
Okay.
I just can't remember.
Yes, Representative Pollard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you remind me what IHS cost was last time?
It was just under 50,000, 49,800, something like that.
Okay. Because we don't put in here what the amount of money might be, because everyone will be right there. Yes, Senator Cook.
Maybe just a comment here. Whoever is going to answer this RFP is not going to get one penny unless they are successful with their answer. If I was running that company, I guarantee I would find out exactly how you wanted the presentation and what information you wanted. The biggest challenge when you do that is when you have multiple people answering that question. If there's one person from the state that can direct what is needed, that'd be a lot more helpful than them getting two or three or four different answers. That's when it gets challenging. But I think the RFP as written has got plenty of detail.
Could we need a motion? Roll call. We need a motion. Was that a motion then? Senator Cook moves with the addition of the people issue in person. Is there a second? Seconded. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please, on the motion? And then get out your calendars.
Chairman Holmberg?
Aye.
Senators Cook?
Aye.
Heckerman?
Aye.
Wardner?
Aye.
Representatives Delzer?
Yes.
Boshi?
Yes.
Clemmine? Pollard?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the motion passes.
Okay, then we have to look at, and this will go out within a couple weeks, you know, be published. We have to be able to let them know what kind of date it is that this is due, and then when we will be having our meeting in Bismarck for this meeting to interview those folks. Looked at the calendar, at one point toyed with an idea of meeting about the same time Representative Pollard is having his meeting, but I think, number one, his meeting is a little earlier than we could be, and number two, probably going to be out of Bismarck, and we need to, I think, be in Bismarck for bringing those, or having those folks come before us. We looked at calendar, and we looked at middle of December, but that, you know, 17, 18, but that seemed a little late. And then looked at the 3rd and 3rd or 4th of December and found that administrative rules is meeting on the 3rd, and there are some folks on this committee that are on administrative rules. So would you look at your calendar and see what December 4th looks like? It's prior to both CSG and NCSL fall meetings, so it doesn't conflict.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that it's prior to the Energy Council, though.
I don't have that on here. When is that?
Well, it would be that Wednesday, Thursday of that first week. It'd be over that first weekend in December.
Okay, that's right after Thanksgiving. Yeah, Thanksgiving is the 28th, and then that weekend ends.
No, the next weekend is when it would be. If anybody was going, they'd have to go on Wednesday.
Okay.
Of that week, and then they'd be gone through Sunday.
Okay, and that's the same time as the CSG annual, roughly.
What date is the 4th?
The 4th is Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I show December 4th through 7th as CSG's annual.
Yeah, I think the 4th is too close.
Monday, that's the Monday after Thanksgiving weekend. Is that a problem?
Might be for the outfit coming in.
Well, we don't want to have it the third because the we have, what, three people on that committee from here? I thought that was too late. Oh, we could go the week, either the 17th or 18th of December. I just heard from voices over here that they don't have a huge objection.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's likely when the budget section will probably meet as well, that week.
Do you want to pick Tuesday and then tell Juan Zick, well, Wednesday's open for you?
Sounds good.
17th?
December
17th. Jeff, is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the week of the 10th is all booked up with CSD and NCSL.
Right, right.
Okay, what's that?
Okay.
For the 17th.
Anything else to come before us? We will, our paths will cross, I'm sure, many times before December 17th.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So then, who gets a hold of Senator Wanzi?
We can talk to him and say that this committee suggested it. That would be a good day to meet.
And it would save the state a lot of money. Right. Okay, if nothing else, could we have a motion for...
Mr. Chairman, oh. don't you need a study plan, or do you? It is RFP handle the study plan.
Yeah, I guess we can kind of just proceed with the study plan the way it's laid out. I guess if we want to have a motion, that would...
Oh, if you don't need no motion, it's no big deal.
Yeah, no, I think we're okay.
Okay. Then let's have a motion to adjourn.
Yep.
And seconded, okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we are adjourned.
You're not going over to the...
No.